Hello and welcome again. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. At the Federalist Society, we pride ourselves on occupying a unique space in public discourse situated squarely at the intersection of law and policy. Similarly situated is our special guest this morning, and he is indeed a remarkably special guest. We're very pleased to have him here. As practitioner of the law at the highest level of the executive branch, Assistant to the President and White House Counsel W. Neil Eggleston, is particularly well qualified to speak on how the laws of the nation shape the implementation of its policies and vice versa. Mr. Eggleston has received his J.D. from Northwestern University Law School in 1978. I spent some time there myself, a little bit later. Upon graduation, he clerked for Judge James Hunter III on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit and later for Chief Justice of the United States, Warren Burger. From 1981 until 1987, he was an assistant U.S. attorney and the chief of appellate attorney for the Southern District of New York, and I imagine he could speak to us for hours about stories from that office. He went on to serve as deputy chief counsel for U.S. House of Representatives Select Committee to investigate covert arms transactions with Iran. And then in the mid-1990s, he served in the White House counsel's office as an assistant counsel to the president. He's also been in private practice with two large international firms, Debevoise & Plimpton and Kirkland & Ellis. Last year, the president appointed Mr. Eggleston White House counsel and assistant to the president. We're delighted to have him here with us today. Please join me in welcoming Neil Eggleston.
Thank you, Dean, for that very kind introduction. I told various people at the White House today that I was coming over here to speak to this group. They all think I'm brave. But I want to thank everybody, and I sincerely mean it, for the opportunity to appear. I'm going to talk for about 15 minutes or so, roughly, I haven't exactly timed it, about recent efforts on criminal justice reform, which got some bipartisan interest. And then I have time for questions if anybody has any questions that they would like to ask me. So in any event, once again, thank you for that really kind introduction. You know, in recent months, the president has been traveling around the United States making the case for criminal justice reform and really helping to drive the national conversation on this topic. He gave a speech in Philadelphia last summer, the NAACP, where he raised the issue. It was also the purpose of his visit to El Reno Prison in Oklahoma. He's the first sitting president actually to go inside of a prison and visit with prisoners there. It was also the key of his message when he traveled to West Virginia in the last several weeks, somewhat forgot exactly when that was, where he spoke to communities about opioid abuse. And that's, you know, as you all know, opioid abuse really frequently starts as prescription drug abuse, and then in a terrible sort of development, people are becoming addicted to heroin really as a result of their addiction to prescription drugs as well. And it was also the theme of remarks a few weeks ago that he gave at the annual conference in Chicago of the International Association of Chiefs of Police, which is the largest law enforcement gathering in the country. We think this is an area where there is genuine bipartisan support and compromise seems distinctly possible, and there are many people on the left and the right who share the goals of reform. Obviously, there have been a lot of differences between the president and conservatives on a lot of different issues. We think this may be one and seems to already be one where there's some agreement, at least among some people on the left and the right, and I hope that that includes people at this organization, the Federalist Society, as well. In my brief remarks, I'd like to say a little bit more about what we mean by criminal justice reform, what we see as a path forward, and how the bipartisan legislative work in Congress would be an important and historic step toward that goal. Let me start with a problem. I'm going to give some figures. Many of these figures are probably quite familiar to people in this room. The United States has just 5% of the world's population, but 25% of its prisoners. We keep more people behind bars than the top 35 European countries combined. The federal government, just the federal government, spends $6 billion a year incarcerating prisoners. And when you add the cost incurred by state and local governments as well, that amount goes up to $80 billion in costs for incarceration. And of course, dollar cost does not include impact on families and individuals and their ability to become reentered into society. As some of you in the room, so I recognize some of you in the room, none of you has to admit that if you don't want to. I really started my experience in criminal justice, as the dean said, as an assistant United States attorney in the Southern District of New York. Most of my time there, Rudy Giuliani was the U.S. attorney. I was hired actually by his predecessor, but Rudy was the U.S. attorney for most of my time. I saw firsthand the damage that crime can inflict on families and communities. I saw the bravery of law enforcement, and I saw the importance of maintaining a strong criminal justice system. Those things obviously are just as true today as they were then. But we believe that the challenges and issues that we face today in our criminal justice system are in many ways fundamentally different. In 1981, the year I became a federal prosecutor in New York, there was a widespread feeling of crime being completely out of control. There were over 1,800 murders in New York in 1981. That is over five times the number of murders there were in New York in 2014. Obviously, the number, which was about a little over 300 last year in New York, every murder is one murder too many, but the difference is pretty staggering. In 1981, there were 369,000 inmates in federal and state prisons. I believe the number today is about 2.2 million. In the narcotics unit, where I spent a significant portion of my time, I'm pretty sure we called it the junk unit. And we called it the junk unit because we largely prosecuted heroin prosecutions. The crack epidemic had not yet, essentially, my memory may be a little rusty on this, but the crack epidemic really came a little bit later in the process. For those of us in the White House who speak about reform to the criminal justice system need to acknowledge that the choices that were made in those years following the increase in crime were made against a background of criminal activity that was destroying our communities, especially poor communities, and that the push for stricter laws, longer sentences, and more policing was not limited to one party nor to particular communities. At the same time, there now seems to be broad agreement that some of the policies put in place in that era are no longer a good match with the challenges that we have today, when we are asking so much more of our criminal justice system and particularly of our law enforcement officers. As the budget for social services, both state and locally, are under and federally are under increasing pressure, our justice system is too often become the final default response for people with mental illness and for people who have addiction. We too much are putting the burden of dealing with mental illness and drug addiction on our police, and it's really not a place that they're particularly equipped to deal with it. You know, this is an area where the states have led and innovated. Governors and legislators in blue states like California and Connecticut, but also red states like Alabama, Georgia, and Texas, have made significant reforms to their criminal justice system. While some efforts began because of fiscal challenges, they will succeed because they embrace fairness and public safety as well as cost. By reducing sentences, especially those of nonviolent drug offenders, and reinvesting some of the savings in either other public safety initiatives, especially programs that address substance abuse and mental illness, these states have achieved better outcomes as a matter of public safety and enhanced trust in the criminal justice system, made better use of taxpayer dollars. There is broad agreement that the federal government has room to pursue similar reforms. Some unusual coalitions are beginning or pressing for that to happen. As Senator Mike Lee, and I believe if my look at your syllabus is right, I think Senator Lee spoke earlier. As he has said, we have prison policies that make rehabilitation the exception rather than the norm, and we have regulations that make it unnecessarily difficult for even reformed offenders to build a new life and earn an honest living after their release. Much more so than the states, the federal inmate population remains heavily weighted towards drug offenders, in large part because of the harsh mandatory minimum sentences that attached to so many of those crimes. I was on hand in February when the President met with a number of members of the House and the Senate, a bipartisan group, to discuss criminal justice reform. That same group, same month, a new group called the Coalition for Public Safety launched with a mission to make our criminal justice system smarter, fairer, and more effective. The organization partners with many of the nation's most prominent conservative and progressive organizations, from those backed by Grover Norquist and Koch Industries to the Center for American Progress and the American Civil Liberties Union. In the spring, a bipartisan summit for criminal justice reform brought together more than 90 speakers in Washington, D.C., at an event hosted by Newt Gingrich and Pat Nolan, among others. Governor Nathan Deal of Georgia, I understand Governor Deal is scheduled at least to talk to you later in the conference, has a son who serves as a state court, drug court judge. During that conference, he spoke movingly about the impact drug courts can have on the lives of those struggling with such addiction and seeking to earn their second chance. Working with Congress, this administration has already made real progress on criminal justice reform. In 2010, for example, the President signed the Fair Sentencing Act, which reduced the disparity in mandatory minimums between crack and powder cocaine sentences. Reduced, did not eliminate, but reduced the disparity. As part of its Smart on Crime initiative, the Department of Justice amended its charging policies so prosecutorial resources are directed to the most serious offenders. Since the start of Smart on Crime, the number of federally charged drug offenses carrying a mandatory minimum has dropped, even as the rate of cooperation and guilty pleas has actually slightly increased. These results are promising, but there is more work ahead. Roughly one-third of the Justice Department budget goes towards incarceration, crowding out resources and personnel available to do everything else that promotes public safety. The Department of Justice has made it a priority to enhance fairness and efficiency at all phases of the criminal justice system, but we in the administration appreciate that only legislation can bring about lasting change to the federal system. We are particularly encouraged by the Sentencing Reform and Corrections Act of 2015, which received a strong bipartisan vote of support in the Senate Judiciary Committee. The bill's co-sponsors included Chairman Chuck Grassley, Senator Mike Lee, and John Cornyn, among others on the Republican side, as well as Senators Durbin, Booker, and Leahy on the Democratic side. The bill would represent an historic step towards reducing mandatory minimum prison sentences for certain nonviolent drug offenders, providing current prisoners the tools and incentives they need to turn their lives around, and giving nonviolent juvenile offenders the second chance that they deserve. By reducing overlong sentences, the bill would free up additional resources available for investments in other public safety measures, including reentry services and programs for mental illness and addiction. We have seen similar proposals introduced in the House with bipartisan support, including a bill from Chairman Goodlatte and Ranking Member Conyers in the House Judiciary Committee, and we're encouraged by that activity as well. The President and his team continue to be optimistic that members on both sides of the issue in both houses will continue to work together on this critical issue in the coming weeks and months and put a meaningful criminal justice bill on his desk for signature. While there are many important initiatives out there, we see the key elements of any such bill as front-end sentencing reform, what we call back-end reform that provides new incentives and opportunities for those incarcerated to participate in programs to reduce recidivism. And finally, as I say, we regard the portion of those bills on juvenile justice reform as also important to give our kids a chance to get their lives back on track. Beyond the federal system, there are important initiatives at the state and local level that the administration is focused on advancing. Of particular importance to me, there's a growing awareness of the hidden costs of paying for our criminal justice system through the imposition of fines and fees that too often undermines trust in law enforcement and effectively criminalizes being poor. We see this in the state and local bail systems that result in nonviolent offenders who pose no threat to the community being forced to spend days or weeks or even months in jail while they await a trial on their offenses. As part of the investigation into Ferguson, the Department of Justice chronicled, and this is not, I'm going to talk about a report that was done as to Ferguson, but we've seen this in other communities as well. Department of Justice chronicled how that city's criminal justice system operated not with the primary goal of administering justice or protecting the rights of the accused, but of maximizing revenue. I was heartened that Missouri enacted bipartisan legislation earlier this year that included measures to end policing practices driven by revenue rather than public safety concerns, a principle that we should all be able to support. And I'm hopeful we continue working together to support state and local reforms that can make a profound difference in lives, people's lives, while also making our system more effective. Let me just close briefly with a comment about the President's Clemency Initiative. This is an area where, obviously, as White House counsel, I'm quite intimately involved. With respect to those already behind bars, there isn't always a legislative remedy. But in their wisdom, the framers gave the president the authority to remedy individual cases of injustice by granting clemency. As constitutional scholars, you all know that this is an enumerated power in the Constitution that vests this power in the President of the United States. At the president's direction, significant reforms have been developed to get worthy petitions before him. The most well-known is the president's Clemency Initiative, an unprecedented effort to promulgate standards and for commutation candidates and to encourage those who qualify to apply. This effort is designed for candidates who meet specified criteria, including individuals who have a clean record in prison and have been sentenced under out-of-date laws that have since been changed and are no longer appropriate to accomplish the goals of sentencing. I believe some of you out here may be members of firms and organizations that are participating in something called Clemency Project 2014. That is an independent organization. It's not affiliated with the White House, not affiliated with the Justice Department, of lawyers and other advocates aimed at providing pro bono assistance to prisoners seeking clemency. The response to this project has been overwhelming. I understand that 1,500 lawyers from more than 300 law firms and organizations nationwide have volunteered to participate. After screening, many inmates will be given legal representation to help them in their clemency petitions, which will then be independently and thoroughly reviewed. There remains much work to be done to see that the results of this effort. President Obama has commuted so far 89 sentences. Had they been sentenced under current law and policies, many of these people would have already been out of jail at the time the clemency was granted. Our activity is ramping up. The president is committed to exercising his clemency power on their behalf, and it is one of my highest priorities through the end of the administration to make sure that the progress is achieved and the program is a success. So, Dean, thank you very much. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here and appear in front of you. And as I say, I have a little bit of time for some questions. And the dean asked me if they had to be on this topic, and I said if I took that position, no one would pay any attention anyway, so.
Thank you very much for being here. You've referred to this all under the rubric of criminal justice reform, but everything you've talked about is criminal sentencing reform, so you're dealing with how long people should serve once they have already been convicted. A bipartisan group of representatives in the House have also supported mens rea reform, which Senator Orrin Hatch has also talked about on the Senate floor. And that, of course, addresses people who arguably should never be convicted of a crime in the first place. And I'm curious whether the president is thinking about, receptive to, talking about meaningful mens rea reform.
So thank you for that question. So I think that So I don't really have an answer to that question, in fairness. And probably wouldn't surprise you that a couple of these you're going to ask or you're not going to really get answers to. I think we focused on the ones, the bills that have been advancing in committee. You know, in a scarce time world, we sort of have to focus on what looks like it's going to happen. That sort of kind of defines my life day in and day out. So we're really focusing primarily on what seems to be advancing. I think that's where we're headed on this. Yes, sir.
Ilya Shapiro from the Cato Institute. And I'll take your suggestion to ask you about something other than criminal justice reform. And that's the legal analysis and approvals going towards executive actions. We've heard over the years of the administration that at certain points OLC has asked for their opinion. Sometimes they're not. Sometimes you keep asking until someone gives you the opinion you want, or not asking because you don't want to hear the wrong answer. To take a specific example, the DAPA immigration actions, where there is no OLC opinion and there's a footnote about perhaps some oral advice, et cetera. So whether you want to talk about specifics or just generally, I was wanting to know about the process of legal analysis in the White House, when the decision is made to ask which lawyer in the government to get approval from, when to put things down on paper. So really a process-based question that you can take as specifically or generally as you
like. Well, let me, you raised the specific example of the immigration executive action, which obviously has made its way back into the news recently, I noticed. So there was an example where we asked OLC for a written opinion. They gave us, as I'm sure you know, an opinion that as to certain aspects that were under consideration we could do, and as to certain aspects that were under consideration we could not do. We did the ones that the OLC said we could do, and we didn't do the one that OLC said we could not do. So I know there's a little bit sort of in the air lately that they're not relied on as much and or whatever. My personal experience is that isn't true at all. They're a very important partner. I care enormously about what they think. And I frankly, they're at the table, and they're a very, very, very important player in the process. I can't really talk about other examples, but I think that's an example where we asked for a written opinion. And when they said we couldn't do something, we couldn't do something. And so we followed it. And then I made a decision, frankly, to publish it because I knew there would be enormous interest in the legal foundation and underpinnings for the president and Secretary Johnson's decisions. And so we made that decision. So I think they're enormously important. And they are definitely at the table and their views sought out. And enormously appreciative for all the great work that they do.
Hi, as a former AUSA, I wanted to thank the administration for its, taking the opportunity to use divided government for perhaps some constructive activity in the area of sentencing reform. And this is related to that topic. There's a lot of discussion of the drugs issue, but sort of hand in hand with that are the felon in possession charges of a firearm, which the department uses to boost its statistics of convictions. They are essentially local, entirely local crimes, which local sheriffs, local police departments then turn over. The department specifically budgets for special AUSAs to put people in prison who would never in a million years have state tax dollars, which are actually restricted by budgets as opposed to deficit spending. And they are mandatory minimums. And they are a very large component of the prosecutorial resources spent in our local U.S. attorney's offices. Is the administration giving any consideration to narrowing the group of people who will be subject to these prosecutions, which are almost entirely localized and rarely involve any actual violence and are simply possession of a firearm while engaged in some other activity, or just based on prior convictions where there's no other criminal activity whatsoever?
Sure. So I think if I'm right on this, that the bill that made it through the Senate Judiciary Committee has a provision that relates to a related issue to that, which is sort of the stacking problem. So one thing that happens in prosecutions is sometimes the way these work, that these mandatory minimum penalties, somebody's nodding, you must be a defense lawyer, can get stacked up. And so the mandatory minimums can really skyrocket in sort of interesting ways. And I think that bill does, in fact, address that sort of fairness issue. So that's the part of this that I've got some kind of knowledge about. The rest of it, I've been out of the prosecution business for a long time, and so so the rest of your question, I don't know that much about. Yes, sir.
My state of Washington recently, by popular initiative, decriminalized recreational marijuana, recognizing that filling the jails with people who otherwise are nonviolent, whose only crime consists in using that drug, didn't serve any particular purpose. What I'm wondering, given how many of our federal inmates are there for drug-related offenses. Do you think that part of the solution could be returning more to the states and having the federal government getting out of the business, deciding what drugs should or should not be criminalized and how people should be punished or how they should be regulated?
So, you know, there's the federal government is certainly involved in the prosecution of criminal offenses, and indeed, many people in the room may know there are Schedule I drugs, Schedule II drugs, Schedule III drugs. Penalties vary depending on which schedule they are in. I think that the federal government has a significant role in drug enforcement, frankly. Much of it is by organized crime or other syndicates. Back when I was a prosecutor, they were sort of La Cosa Nostra. That's, you know, it's a sort of different group now, frankly, than they used to be. But there are large-scale organizations that simply, as to which the federal government is best positioned to bring those sorts of resources. So I think that's the reason that we are trying to focus on making sure that there's not an unfairness in the enforcement and implementation process, so that people who are nonviolent, relatively low roles, and get punished consistent with their role. And I think that's one of the real goals of the Grassley bill, including some reduction of mandatory minimums, but those of you who have followed it. The other thing it has done is to open up, if passed, it would open up the discretion to the district judge, what the sentencing judge, what they call the safety valve. And so there'd be some greater ability by the sentencing judge to look more specifically in the facts of circumstances of the case, the circumstances of the defendant, and give a more sort of thoughtful penalty as a result of that. And so we think that's a good development in that bill.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Mr. Edelson, thank you so much for joining us today. We remain delighted to have hosted you here. We certainly appreciate it. To our audience, we're going to be serving lunch, and the next panel will begin as soon as possible. So thank you so much.
Thank you.